So, good afternoon. I'm Paul Tushade. I'm with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. So this will be a little bit of a different talk. I'm going to give you an overview of how we do discharge planning from Rikers Island. And I'll talk a little bit about the process, how we do the discharge planning and getting linkage to care, and then focus a little bit on one segment of our program, the home visit team, give you a little bit of data on that. And then, since we don't have data on home visit team linkages specifically, I'm going to also share with you some preliminary data from a SPINS research study that we're participating in. Since we've been talking about SPINS, we'll just keep it going. I have no disclosures to make regarding finances either. Allison Jordan, who's also here, is the executive director of THCC. So for those of you who are not familiar with Rikers Island, and hopefully that's most of you, we are in fact an island located between Bronx and Queens. The line at the bottom of the screen is the bridge that physically connects us to Queens. And all the little things, the labels with lines pointing down are pointing to all the various jail facilities. So there are, I think it's 9 active jails currently, one of them devoted to women, one for adolescents. There are 2 that are infirmaries. So there are many, many facilities on the island, some more specialized than others. All have health clinics in the facilities. And there is, well, there's a lot of care going on. I'll get to that in a second. But we're one of the largest jail systems in the country. So we have about 100,000 annual admissions. The average daily census is between 12.5 and 13,000. And not shown on this diagram are 2 other facilities, the Bronx Detention Center, which would be directly above where it says Rikers Island. That would be right off the coast of the Bronx. It's an actual barge floating in the river. And then in Lower Manhattan is the Manhattan Detention Center. So this map is a overlay of where people say they are leaving Rikers and going home to, and income levels. So it's a map of all 5 boroughs of New York City. So you can see very clearly how in the redder areas signifying lower income, there's also a large number of people returning from jail. And you can see it's not only spread around the city, but also concentrated in some particular areas. So Upper Manhattan, the South Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens communities that Brooklyn, Queens border communities. And this is where the people we serve in jail are returning home to. So you can see it affects a great number of communities throughout New York City. Demographics of the population on Rikers, they're predominantly young and African American and Latino. So these are also, again, the same demographics for people who are most at risk right now. Women do represent about 12% of the population on Rikers Island. So just to give you a little bit of background on how we function on Rikers, Correctional Health Services is part of the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, and we oversee the provision of care that's delivered on the island. The care is actually delivered by an outside vendor, Corizon, but there is a medical director through the Department of Health who oversees all the care and supervises the care provided. And there are 78,000 roughly medical visits every month. Care is delivered, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So there's a great deal of care being provided to inmates on the island. The other thing that makes Rikers a little bit unique is that this past year we went live with an electronic health record system. So all of the facilities are now live with ECW, eClinical Works, which is the same record medical record system that New York City rolled out to its community health clinics in the past few years. So we're now all using the same record. We're not actually exchanging data right now between the island and the other community health clinics, but that's a possibility down the road. But more importantly, we are now able to exchange information on the island. So it makes a huge difference just in being able to access information. So it's the same information, it's just now accessible much more readily. And this has also really helped us in the way we are able to do discharge planning because we're now able to see who was admitted to the system and self-identified as living with HIV when they were admitted. So every morning there is a person from Transitional Healthcare Coordination who will look in the system and generate a report to see who was admitted, which facility are they in, and then upload that information to the people working at that facility, to the staff. And so they know that this person is in my facility and has self-identified as living with HIV, and maybe I should approach them and offer our services to them. So just to what it says, Transitional Healthcare Coordination, we provide discharge planning for everyone who says they're living with HIV, and we also deal with people who are chronically ill and at risk for HIV. So I mentioned a little bit about how we identify the people. We first use the self-disclosure at intake to create a list that we then approach people. Inevitably, there are more people who self-disclose after some time of being incarcerated because maybe they didn't feel comfortable disclosing at intake. So those discharge planners in the facilities will then meet and offer the services to the clients, to the person. And if they accept, then they become a client of THCC. They create a very comprehensive discharge plan, full needs assessment, figure out the kind of care that they need. And then the appropriate referrals are made for whatever care is necessary for that client upon release, whether it's outpatient, inpatient, nursing home, whatever their needs are, we will try and do our best to accommodate everyone when they get released. And we work with many, many community-based partners. We have memorandum of understanding with, I think it's close to 200 providers throughout New York City. But we work with some a little more closely, and those are the Rikers Island Transitional Consortium partners. And so these community-based organizations, Exponents, Palladia, the Fortune Society, and Women's Prison Association, are a little unique in that they actually have staff who come out to Rikers Island or able to meet with the clients pre-release. So they're able to come out and see someone, meet with them, describe the services that could be offered to them when they get released. And we think that would have give that person an advantage and hopefully improve the odds that they will get linked to services. All of them provide case management. Several of them do provide transitional housing. And Fortune Society is a little unique in that they do all of that, and they also have a minibus that is able to actually transport people off the island, which is sometimes necessary depending on when people get released or their particular needs. So that's very helpful. So one of the things that we've also started doing is figuring out, of everyone who got released, what was their status at 90 days. And so we're always working to get people connected and confirm that the connection to care was made. But now we're also looking to see what happened to that client at the 90-day mark. Were they still in care? Had they fallen out of care? Or were they reincarcerated? So we've begun doing that. We recognize that those first 30 days are very, very critical to making that connection happen and getting it to really stick. If a client is released, the goal is for them to get connected to care within the first 7 days. That's always our goal. But if they don't get connected to care, to a primary care provider within the first 30 days of release, we refer them essentially back to ourselves, back to our home visit team. And the home visit team is a specialized team of the Transitional Healthcare Coordination Program that is, they're community-based, but they work in the field. They also work in the courts. They also have someone who's dedicated or who specializes in doing court advocacy, and he works to get people either reduced sentences or alternative to incarcerations. So if someone's eligible for a treatment program or some other program that might reduce their sentence or get them to go into a program as opposed to incarceration, there is one person we have who does that kind of advocacy work. But in general, they're out in the field, and they have access to the various systems, the electronic health record system, the Department of Corrections systems. So they're able to access various databases to try and locate clients who've been released. So they do all the traditional things, whether it's use phone numbers, send certified letters, or if they have addresses, go out and make a home visit. If they don't have an exact address, they will just go to the area and try and find the person in the community. And then once they locate the person, they reoffer the services that we provide in jail to the client in the community. They also will, along with doing that, providing the service of connection to care and the case management, they will also offer to pick the client up and transport them and accompany them, even sit with them at the clinic. So what I wanted to show here, this is data from 12 months, a 12-month period for the home visit team, and it's really just to show the great variation in the number of referrals that they receive month to month. The second column, UTL, is unable to locate. So of the clients who were referred to them, the number they were unable to locate, how many they found, and then what you have is their find rate. So they're able to actually find 84% of these folks who were released and were unconnected at 30 days post-release. So just reiterating those aggregate numbers. So they found, in this 12-month period, of the 658 referrals received, they found 550, and 28% of them were found to be reincarcerated. So we do have a pretty high reincarceration rate. Then of those who were eligible for a connection, they were able to connect, another again, 84%, 319. So just to define eligibility, it means that the client was in the community, not in jail, and that they were still living in New York City and eligible for a connection. So that's really all it is. So of those who were unconnected, 7% they were unable to engage, and we have that as a separate category because it's kind of significant. These are folks who never said no but didn't actually follow through, so kind of stringing the staff along. So that's not a big number, but it's still a significant number every month. And then there's only 2% of people who actually refused the services. So they actually said, no, thank you, I really don't want your services. What I'm not showing, the remainder, are people who had either died, moved out of the New York City area, or had some other issue, maybe held by immigration or something else that left them ineligible for a connection. So now I'm going to do a sharp turn and talk about our SPINS data, since we don't, as I said, have any data yet about our 90-day status or about the home visit team. We do have some preliminary data from our ongoing research study. We're participating in the SPINS Enhancing Linkages to Care study, which is a HRSA-funded grant. It's a multi-site evaluation at 10 sites around the country. Emory and Apt Associates are the lead. They're the evaluation and technical support center for this study. And the goal is really to identify the facilitators and barriers to getting people connected to care upon release from jail. So this is just the first group of folks who we had follow-up data on. So we at Rikers Island enrolled over we enrolled now, it's 555 we have in our study. So of those who were released and made it to 6 months, this is their baseline data compared to the 6-month follow-up. So baseline data was collected in jail at their index incarceration, not their first incarceration, just the incarceration at which the study was offered to them, and they agreed to enroll into and participate in the research study. And the research study was essentially a survey that captured their demographics, substance abuse history, housing information, HIV care treatment history. I'm trying to think of what else we got. We got the SF-12, so some scoring yet to be done, but I have one question here that I'm showing you. And the same survey was also collected at 6 months. Plus, we also, upon release, we did a jail chart review to collect the clinical data directly from the medical record. And then at 6 months, another follow-up clinical review was done. So you can see that there was some significant changes. They all had improved, on average, improved CD4 cells. Viral loads had dropped significantly. I can tell you that the number of people with undetectable viral load doubled from 20% to 40%. And just the drop also in the average viral load means that this is also a drop in the community viral load. So if you're interested in that or are thinking about that, this is a big, you know, I think it's a big thing to look at, that people getting care in jail are having an impact on the community viral load. Also, they were far more likely to report taking their antiretrovirals in the 7 days prior to the interview, so 97% were, as compared to 59% at baseline. And they were much more likely to, they were much more adherent. So they were at better than 90% adherence at 6 months compared to under 80% at baseline. The current health question is actually the SF12 question number one, which is simply, how would you rate your current health? And it's from one being excellent to five being poor. And so the lower number is actually better. It's stating that their health, in their own self, their perception of their own current health had improved at follow-up. Also, there was a huge drop in people who had reported any homelessness in the 30-day period prior to the interview. It was only 9% at 6 months compared to 30% at baseline. And a big surprise to us and to others was the big drop in ED utilization. So this is actually, the score is a little funny, but it's a 0 to 1. They were much less likely to go to an emergency department for care in the 6 months post-release compared to 6 months prior to baseline. And I can tell you that the person who had the highest utilization still went to the ED, but it had dropped by half. So big, big drop in ED visits. So why are we doing all of this? Why are we doing the discharge planning? I have a home visit team who's working out in the field, working in the courts, and doing the research studying. And the reason is because with a home visit team, this is a real valuable opportunity to find people who would otherwise have been lost. You know, they did something that landed them in jail, and in jail, they got care. And then as soon as they get released, what happens? If they don't get linked to care, that's a real tragedy, because it was an opportunity of someone who was receiving care in jail, and now they may have fallen through the cracks again. So we see this as a very important opportunity to get those folks reconnected to care. There are also some serious cost savings implications, because again, if you're able to get people connected to care and take care of themselves, become engaged in their care, you can improve their, maintain their health, and also as shown, they'll be going to the emergency department less for emergency care. Most importantly, it's really because we recognize that every incarceration is an opportunity for a public health intervention, and that correctional health really is public health, because if you are working with that client in the jail, you're not working with just that client. You're actually going to have an impact beyond that client for when they get released and return to their community. So as I alluded to before with community viral load, you're also returning people who may be healthier, may be re-engaged with their care, may be thinking about their medical care for the first time in quite a while. So we really think of this as a public health intervention. So just for us, our next steps are to look at the data of the home visit team, people who did require that added assistance. How did they compare to other folks who were connected without that assistance? We also have some data that will allow us to do a retrospective study of people who we served and were living with HIV in jail, who we served and provided a discharge plan, compared to those who we did not serve. And then what we're actually already begun doing is looking at recidivism for those who were followed up with the SPINS research study compared to those who were actually lost to follow-up. So we're looking at all the 550 folks who enrolled their prior 12-month incarceration history and then doing a follow-up 12-month incarceration history to see what's going on in terms of recidivism. And that's it. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Are you doing anonymous testing, and what is the prevalence in the population of writers? And also, are you doing outreach and testing to get more people
Yes, so everyone who is admitted to Rikers Island is offered an HIV test at intake. So within 24 hours of admission, they must receive a full medical examination, and part of that is an offer of an HIV test. It is not an anonymous test, but they are offered HIV testing. It is voluntary. They must opt in. So we don't have opt out. They have to agree to get tested. But everyone is offered a test. For those who are newly diagnosed, they actually get sort of funneled to another program that works with the newly diagnosed. So they get a little more intensive education on HIV and medication adherence. So we don't work with those newly diagnosed. But the prevalence, you know, we used to say it was about 5%. So everyone who works in Correctional Health Service, anyone who's involved in provision of care, is obviously trained on confidentiality. But you were speaking specifically about how it related to their medications. It's we have the same problems as well, although we try and work with those folks a little more intensely and encourage them to start treatment if they weren't on treatment. But it is a challenge. The way it works is that people are given 7 days worth of treatment and they have their supply with them. And so, everyone is trained. The corrections officers are trained and are aware of who is living with HIV, and so, they're aware of, which patients they need to be a little more concerned about. I don't know what just happened. But they're... there. It's hard because or they can go for daily observed. Right.
I'd like the clinic staff to be a little more vocal about the opportunities for DOT, but it's a systems issue for them. So the frequency of the offer of DOT is probably not universal, but if our staff know that they would see there's an issue for someone, we can arrange it with that plan.
Okay.
We also have 5 ID docs specifically working with our patient manager, the team who works with the HIV newly diagnosed folks, also does treatment experience counseling during people's life to stay while they're in question.
And people are, when they get released, they're released with a prescription, a 21-day prescription for meds, and they're also released with a 7-day supply. And we just recently revamped that system, that process, so that we now control the meds. So we know who's going to need meds when they get released. We make sure that they get the meds. Yes?
I've had a very, very impressive program, and I've been very much aware of the other places that have skills granted. My hat's off to you. What a great job you're doing.
Thank you.
Are you pre-certifying people or doing the paperwork for AGAP for those folks as well?
Yes. Well, in the jails, people have a chance to meet with Medicaid screeners and to have the forms done. It really depends on a lot of factors, including how long they're actually there. Do they have the time while they're on the island to go through that whole process? So if they're long enough, then yes, they can get pre-screened and have things ready. Also in New York State, if someone's on Medicaid, their Medicaid only gets suspended when they're incarcerated, so it doesn't get canceled. It's suspended for 30 days, so it's not turned off. But yes, in general, if they're there long enough, they can get screened for the benefits. We also work closely with HASA, which does housing for in New York City. So we're able to pre-screen people for their housing eligibility, which I think is a big reason why the percentage reporting homelessness was so much lower at follow-up.
You also have a very good mental health caseworker system as well.
Yes. So. Right. So what I didn't mention was that for those living with HIV who also are severely mentally ill, they will be co-discharge planned, so to speak, through our mental health discharge planning unit. And we work with them, but more often than not, they will be the lead on that plan. We will provide the input for the medical care, but they will really be the lead on that person's discharge plan, and there's a lot of reasons why that happens in New York City. We don't need to get into. Any other questions? Thank you.